Eastern world, it is exploding.
Welcome to Geopolitics Decanted. I'm Dmitry Alperovich, chairman of Silverado Policy Accelerator, a geopolitics think tank in Washington, D.C., and a co-author of an upcoming book, World on the Brink, How America Can Beat China in the Race for the 21st Century, that comes out on April 30th. Today's podcast will be a little bit different because it will be a conversation about the book with my co-author, Garrett Graff, an accomplished and very prolific author of numerous books on national security topics and history, and who has another book coming out in June as well, When the Sea Came Alive, an oral history of D-Day, which comes out right in time for the 80th anniversary of that invasion. At the end of the podcast, we'll also have a very special treat for you, an excerpt from our book, more specifically the prologue, which describes a fictional but very realistic scenario for Chinese invasion of Taiwan. I spent a lot of time working through how China might orchestrate this extraordinarily difficult operation, perhaps one of the most complex in the history of warfare. If you spend any time on the island of Taiwan, you get an immediate appreciation for the enormous challenge the terrain would present to China, from the stormy waters in the Taiwan Strait, to the narrow and fire-controlled beaches, to the rivers, mountains, tunnels, and bridges that are all over this island. It is truly a natural fortress, an absolutely hellish place to invade. But it could be done, and I think the scenario in our book plausibly describes the more likely way that it could potentially unfold. I hope you find it interesting and educational. But let's get on with the podcast. Garrett, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Dmitry. This will be fun.
Yeah, so it's been so much fun to write this book with you. Really appreciate the partnership on it. And let's get into it and tell everyone what's in this book.
So, you know, what's funny about this is that this book started almost exactly 2 years ago around your dining room table. And I thought I would start off by asking you to talk a little bit about what your hope was for the book and what the motivation was to write it in the first place.
Yeah. So as I told you at the time, I was very emotionally impacted by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And in fact, I had been focused on that war for the preceding many months, and was one of the first forecasters that came out in December of the prior year and said that I'm getting convinced that President Putin is going to launch this ruinous war before the end of the winter. And unfortunately, that did come to pass. And, you know, sometime later, I actually received this incredible emotional email from a Ukrainian immigrant to the UK who had stumbled upon my writings and my predictions and convinced his family to leave the city of Kharkiv in eastern Ukraine right before the war, February 15th. He said he had convinced them to finally flee the country for what he described to them as a vacation because they did not believe the war would come, his parents, his siblings. And he said, go to Turkey, I bought your tickets, you'll come back in a few weeks. They never came back, and their neighborhood was shelled by Russian artillery. It was on the outskirts of the city, and a number of their neighbors unfortunately perished. And, you know, as I was looking at that whole situation and the reasons for why I was convinced that Putin was going to launch this war, it was striking to me how many of those reasons, all of them really, were also applicable to the situation halfway around the world in the Indo-Pacific. And I was getting more and more convinced over the prior years that we are on a path to conflict with China. And I thought that, you know, if I was able to do some good, unfortunately not as much as I could have, or as much maybe as was possible, to warn about the threat of war in Ukraine, fortunately it was too late to deter it, maybe we can do some good with ringing the alarm bells about this coming conflict, which could be 1,000 times more impactful in terms of lives lost, destruction of global economy, impact to America's national security. And fortunately, unlike with Ukraine, which was imminent and literally a couple of months out, with this conflict, I think we have some years. I don't think that China is likely to launch a conflict before 2028. So we have at least 4 years, six at the time we started writing this book. And it was important, A, to tell the American public and really the world of why I'm convinced that this conflict is on a very dangerous trajectory. And also, most importantly, to lay out of the grain strategy for how do we deter this conflict and make sure it never happens. And overall, how do we put it in the context of America's grand strategy and try to outline what all of us, not just the 300 people in the DC foreign policy community that you and I talk to a lot, but really average Americans out there and Europeans and many others that I hope read this book, can do to try to reduce the chance of this conflict, because it's really up to all of us to try to do this, because this war, boy, it really could turn into World War III between two nuclear powers. It's something that no one on this planet should want to see.
So let me, before we get too deep into talking about China and Taiwan, let me back up for listeners here, not all of whom know your history. You know, one of the things that really stands out in your commentary and analysis of Russia and Ukraine is you're Russian. You're born in Russia, came to the United States, and have this great view of sort of the both superpowers and what makes them tick and think. You also, though, have been on the front lines for the last 15 years of America's battle against China. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, the story of your work in cybersecurity. In many ways parallels the arc of America waking up to the threat posed by China to the global order. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and talk a little bit about, Operation Aurora and some of your work there. One of the things I do like about the book, I'm obviously biased as a co-author, but I think you do a really good job of laying out your personal experience, both in Russia and on the China issue, and how that's shaped your view of, you know, this sort of three superpowers and their struggle in the 21st century.
Yeah, and I have to confess, I have you to blame for that, because you pushed me really hard to put more of myself and my biography in that book, which I was hesitant to do, but you were absolutely right to do so. So look, yes, I've always been passionate, by the way, I should say, about foreign policy, national security. I studied in college along with cybersecurity courses, but then went into this technical cyber career. And for the first 10 years of my career, really my hobbies and interests in foreign policy did not interface with my professional life. And that all changed in January of 2010, when I got a call from a company called Google, and they wanted to cooperate with me. I was at the time running global threat research operations for a large cybersecurity company, on an investigation of a hack into their networks that they suspected was coming from China. And that ultimately led to broad investigation into dozens of companies that have been compromised in that same operation by the Chinese government, that I ended up calling Operation Aurora. The reason I named it Aurora, by the way, is with a nod to history, including Soviet history, because Aurora is the name of the battleship in St. Petersburg that in 1917 fired the shot that was a signal to Lenin to launch the Bolshevik Revolution. It's been called the shot heard around the world that changed the course of the 20th century. And I believed immediately, as I started looking at that hack, that it was going to change the industry forever. And in fact, it did, because it was the first time really that anyone had encountered nation state actors, China in particular, in a public sphere, breaking into commercial entities for economic espionage purposes. And I immediately realized that this was likely to lead to something bigger, that this was likely to be occurring not just at Google and a few other companies, but probably in many other places. And indeed, that led me to uncover more and more operations, both from China and later other nation state actors, led me to co-found CrowdStrike a year later in 2011. So it changed my life, and it changed really, I think, the industry, and set me on a trajectory of doing a lot of investigations into Chinese espionage over the course of the next decade or so and seeing them break into virtually every company on the planet that had intellectual property that was an interest of Chinese companies or Chinese state, breaking into government networks. And I sounded the alarm in those early days. I called it the greatest transfer of wealth in history, something that's been repeated by, at the time, the director of the FBI, director of the NSA. And look, you know, at the time, I've called that this is a national security threat, that China is trying to wage economic warfare against us. And for many years, I couldn't get anyone in the government to listen or pay attention to this.
So let's talk a little bit more about this challenge that China poses over the next 5 to 10 years. Why does Taiwan matter to that equation, and why should the U.S. care about it?
It's a great question. So we've heard some of the discussion of Taiwan in this current presidential campaign cycle, but it's been very reductionist, very simplistic. Some people have said, well, Taiwan matters to us only as long as it keeps producing semiconductors, chips, computer chips. And as long as we achieve independence of Taiwan, it's going to stop mattering to us, right? And that's run on two counts. A, Taiwan mattered to us long before chips were even a thing. In fact, in 1950, General MacArthur, Douglas MacArthur, famously called it the unsinkable aircraft carrier because it's of its strategic position in Asia. And two, it's also wrong because the semiconductor issue is not going to be solved anytime soon. And there's no prospect of Taiwan not mattering for semiconductor production for decades to come. A lot of people talk about the CHIPS Act that was passed by Congress a couple of years ago that gives $52 billion in grants to industry. About $40 billion of that is actually direct grants, another $12 billion or so in research initiatives, and another 25 or so billion in tax breaks to the semiconductor manufacturers. But most don't appreciate that that's a drop in the bucket for the chips industry. I mean, a modern fab these days could cost as much as $20 billion to build. So that $52 billion, or really $40 billion, is not going to go a long way. And the goal of that CHIPS Act is actually to just stabilize the disappearance of the semiconductor industry from U.S. shores. So the U.S., of course, invented this critical industry. We invented transistors, we invented semiconductors and broader microelectronics industry. Over the last 40 years, we've mostly outsourced the manufacturing of these chips to Asia, to Taiwan, to Korea, Singapore, Japan, in other places. And we are now finding ourselves in a situation where only 12% of the world's chips are actually being produced in America. And that's been coming down for years now. And the attempt of the CHIPS Act is to stabilize it, maybe increase a little bit. I mean, some of the most optimistic estimates are that maybe if everything works perfectly with the CHIPS Act, we'll get to about 20% of the world's semiconductors being manufactured in the United States. But it's not going to be any sort of overwhelming numbers, and certainly not going to be sufficient to make ourselves independent of Taiwan. But Taiwan matters to us way more than just as a chip producing nation. It matters to us because of its geographic location and because of what it means to the entire region, right? If you look at China, and we have this map in the book that we put in there, if you rotate the map and put China at the top, looking outward at the Pacific Ocean, you can see that China is effectively contained, and that's how they view themselves, by U.S. military bases and U.S. allies. So it starts from the east with the South Korean Peninsula, where we have almost 30,000 troops stationed there and significant military capabilities, then onward to Japanese islands, where we also have military bases, then on to Taiwan, is viewed by China as really an outpost of the U.S., and then on to the Philippines, where once again, after several decades of absence, we have military bases in Luzon that we're building up there. So China looks at the world as being contained by U.S. forces and U.S. allies. And as it wants to realize its ambitions of being a global superpower, of being able to project its power both across its region and ultimately globally, it needs to break out of this first island chain, as it's often called. And Taiwan sits at the center of it. And obviously, there's a historical element to their desire to take Taiwan. They believe, we write in the book quite wrongly, that Taiwan has always belonged to China. That's actually not correct. They believe it's their destiny to take Taiwan because it's sort of unfinished business from the Chinese Civil War, when they didn't really defeat the nationalists because Chiang Kai-shek and his 2 million nationalists were able to flee mainland China in 1949 and set up on Taiwan and establish a sort of a counter to the mainland China, still called the Republic of China. So for many reasons, including strategic ones, they desire to take Taiwan, but it's also why it matters to the United States. And I've had conversations with senior officials in the region, including Japan, for example, where they've told me that if China takes Taiwan, it's going to immediately change the entire dynamic of that region, where the U.S. will immediately lose most of its relevance. It'll be pushed far into the Eastern Pacific. And everyone from Japan and other countries in the region will have to accommodate China as sort of the new sheriff in town that sets the rules of the game. In many ways that you've seen this play out on the periphery of Russia, right? So if you look at the Central Asian states, if you look at states in the Caucasus like Armenia that are effectively operating within Russia's sphere of influence, it's not because they desire to do so. It's because they have no choice, because they're relatively weak powers compared to Russia. The U.S. is far away and cannot be relied on. So they have to accommodate Russia and Russia's interests. And you will have the same dynamics play out in the most important region of the world, arguably, where you have 50% of the world's GDP, most of the economic growth, most of the world's supply chains, and China will dominate that region if they take Taiwan.
You mentioned this in your answer, but one of the things that was interesting in the research of this book was coming to understand Taiwan's history, that it has never belonged to China in the way that I think President Xi's rhetoric makes it seem like, the reunification of Taiwan is this great piece of unfinished business. And one of the things, as you get into the history of the island, is that actually the same government has never controlled the island of Taiwan and mainland China at the same time. That actually over the course of really 2,000 years, Taiwan has been an island, as we say in the book, mostly of only attempted conquest, with chapters of colonization by the Portuguese, Spanish, Japanese, and ultimately the Han Chinese. But that, you know, this sort of idea that I think the many people in the West wrongly have, that like, well, Taiwan's always been a part of China, and it's only since 1947 that it's broken apart, actually is just not true. And that, you know, one of the things that's really striking in the Taiwanese political tradition, and you traveled to Taiwan as part of the research for this book, is coming to understand just how separate the Taiwanese political and cultural background is from, you know, mainland communist China.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a great story in the book about an American expedition that landed on Taiwan in the 1800s and was slaughtered by the natives on the island, who, by the way, the native people of Taiwan are not Han Chinese, they're Pacific Islanders. And even though now the Taiwanese population is mostly Han Chinese, because in part of the migrations from China over the last couple of centuries, 70% of the people in Taiwan actually trace their bloodlines back to the indigenous populations and the culture of the indigenous population. Their cuisines are, I mean, more resurrected and being admired and celebrated in Taiwan. But in the 1800s, you had this American expedition landing on the island, being slaughtered by the natives, and then complaining to the Chinese emperor to do something about this, because nominally he had power over the island. And the Chinese emperor basic response to the American president was, deal with it yourself. I don't fully control Taiwan. A remarkable response, but only highlighting the fact that this island was so uncontrollable for so many years and never fully belonged to China.
So now, Dmitry, there are a lot of books that get written and a lot of books that have been written over the last 5 years about, you know, the threat from China, the new Cold War, the, you know, blah, 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 blah. One of the things you really wanted to do in shaping this book and setting out to write it was not just, as Dennis McDonough used to say, admire the problem. You know, let's state the problem. Let's point it out. Let's be honest and upfront about it. But we actually need a game plan to get to the other side. And I wonder if you could talk both about the arc of what you see in the Chinese-U.S. relationship and then how we get there. Because I think one of the things that's really striking in the book and your worldview is, you know, for all of the talk about this being like the fateful century or, you know, the next 50 years or the next 100 years of superpower, you know, you really talk about this as really something that's like really just the next decade or two. And I wonder if you could talk about the timeline that you see, why that timeline matters, and what the U.S. needs to do to get to the other side.
Yeah. So at its heart, this is a grand strategy book. And maybe this is my background as an entrepreneur. I tend to be very impatient, particularly with people that just want to admire problems. And I want to get to solutions and try to figure out how to solve problems. Much of the book is really focused on how do we solve this problem? How do we actually win this Cold War? And there's no question in my mind that we're in a Cold War. I've believed that for many years. But, you know, it's been so fascinating to do the research for this book because we go back into Cold War I history in the book as well. And on every level, this is just like Cold War I with the Soviet Union. And I didn't fully even appreciate the sheer volume of similarities that translate. And I think it's worth for our listeners to just list some of them. But you have unquestionably a global competition for supremacy that's taking place, much like you had during Cold War I, as we call it, between Soviet Union and America. You now have it between China and the United States. You have preparations for war, both countries building up their militaries, reorienting their strategies and changing up their forces to prepare for this conflict. You have an arms race going on, both a conventional one and a nuclear one, because China, as we now know, has been revealed by the U.S. intelligence community, is increasing dramatically its nuclear arsenal, going from about 300 nuclear warheads to over 1,000 by the end of the decade, increasing the number of missile silos, nuclear armed submarines, and the like. You have a space race, both countries trying to conquer that domain as much as they can. You have economic warfare, both in terms of trade wars, economic espionage that's being waged by China against the United States, and so forth. You have an ideological struggle. It's a little bit different from the first one. It's less ideological, as in communism versus capitalism, but it's more of authoritarianism versus democracy, as President Biden himself talks about, even though he would not admit the framing of the Cold War as we do. You have a major regional flashpoint, Taiwan being in this conflict. West Berlin was the flashpoint that almost took us to a war, including a nuclear war in the 1960s. You have a scramble for military bases. We're setting up bases in the Philippines. We're increasing our presence in Taiwan and Japan in that whole region, while the Chinese are trying to do the same, setting up bases in Pakistan, in Cambodia, even as far away as Africa and Djibouti. You have an espionage war. You know, much of the Cold War was characterized by this secret spy war. You have the same thing happening now with China, both in cyberspace and in the physical world. The FBI director, Christopher Wray, often talks about how this is the highest level of espionage that the FBI has ever encountered in terms of just pure scale, and most of it is coming from China. And I also make the case in the book that this Cold War, actually, just like the first one, began much earlier than we realize. So most people think that Cold War began after World War II, somewhere in 1946, 47 timeframe, with the Churchill speech in Missouri talking about the Iron Curtain descending across Europe, Eastern Europe. And I actually make the case in the book that I think it started in 1920 when the hot war that most Americans have forgotten about, but we were actually in a conflict with Russia from 1918 to 1920, where we deployed troops in Siberia and the Far East in support of Western coalition to try to defeat the Bolsheviks and support the white forces in Russia in the Russian Civil War. As soon as that war ended, the lessons that the Bolsheviks took away from that is that the United States and primarily the United Kingdom, who they at the time viewed as a number one threat, are determined to snuff out communism, and that they were in this existential fight that had to be waged covertly initially, but also building up their military for an eventual conflict. So they've been focused on that for 25-6 years before we realized that we were in a Cold War. Similarly with China, they've been focused on this for a very long time, at least since the 1970s. You could even make the case even earlier. And we just woke up to this in the last maybe 10 years, if we're being generous. So on every level, this conflict resembles the first one. And again, thinking about what is a grand strategy for actual victory, right? George Kennan, in his long telegram after World War II that he sent from Moscow, articulated the strategy that we then used to defeat the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And his great insight was that the Soviet Union was fundamentally an unnatural phenomena, that the Soviet Union would one day collapse. And if we just wait it out, if we manage to deter war, we're going to win. Well, with China, it's quite a bit different because China, of course, has existed for 5,000 years, likely will exist for another 5,000 years or longer. It's not going anywhere. It's not going to collapse. And defining what victory looks like is one of the things that we try to do in the book, because as we argue, American superpower position in the century, while not assured, is still very likely to remain if we manage to do a few things right, and particularly if we defend in our innovation and if we make sure that we dominate the technologies that will define the 21st century. And we argue in the book that there are four critical technologies to that winning of that race. It is AI and autonomy, kind of self-explanatory as we look at what's been happening over the last couple of years in the advancements in that area. It's biotech and synthetic biology, both in the medical sciences space, but also in the creation of new materials that you might see in the coming decades in that field. It is the aerospace technologies that will dominate the space industry. And it is the green tech, as we call it, the energy technologies that will be the future of energy as we transition to this net zero carbon world. And there are two critical components that you need in the dominance of all of those four things, which is semiconductors and critical minerals, rare earths and other critical minerals like cobalt and nickel and many others. So those are the things that we need to absolutely assure that we have resiliency in our supply chain for in terms of the components. And we're investing in innovation and we're defending our innovation when it comes to those technologies to make sure that we stay far ahead of China. And China, as we talk about, has numerous problems. It has enormous economic problems. We've talked about this on this podcast before, but they've reached the middle income trap much earlier than most other well-off countries, and the growth is stagnating. They're facing just an absolute population collapse this century, where they're going to go from well over a billion people in population that they have today to potentially as low as 500 million, maybe 550 million by the end of the century. That is a collapse unheard of in human history. And obviously from a geopolitical strategic perspective, they are contained in that region today through U.S. alliances, through U.S. military bases. So if we manage to maintain that status quo and avoid war and avoid them capturing Taiwan and dominating Asia, which could lead to them having a preeminent position on the world stage as well, we can absolutely win this Cold War. And we talk about the military strategy, reforms of defense industrial base, the trade strategies, the technology strategies, sort of looking at all aspects of this Cold War too and outlining how do we actually win it.
Why should the average non-Washington policy insider care about reading this book?
Well, A, if they care about what I believe is the number one threat in the world to our lifestyle, to our well-being, to American lives that could potentially be lost in this conflict, which by the way, could exceed the, at least on a daily count basis, the number of lives we lost at any point during World War II, right? You're an expert on D-Day. The number of Americans we lost on that day would be dwarfed, looking at just daily casualties, by a potential conflict with China. Not to mention that these are two nuclear armed powers, and keeping that conflict, A, contained to that region, and B, contained to a conventional conflict versus a nuclear conflict, would be an enormous challenge in and of itself. So this is, I believe, a train that's coming full speed ahead at us, and we have to do whatever it takes to deter it. And that job is not just for people in the White House, people in the U.S. military, in the Pentagon. It is a job for all of us, because the challenge with deterrence, of course, is you never know when you've had enough of deterrence, because at the end of the day, you're doing something that can be measured, which is impacting the thinking and the decision making of the other side, of the other party, right? And in the nuclear space, this is why we go all out and make sure that we've done absolutely everything possible so that our adversaries know that we can and will retaliate against them in a devastating fashion should they ever think about launching a nuclear weapon at our country, right? That is why we have invested sort of in overkill capabilities, having land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles in silos across the United States, having nuclear armed submarines, having bombers with nuclear weapons loaded on them. You know, one could argue that, you know, hundreds of missiles is good enough. They're distributed across the United States, but we say, no, it's not enough. Let's do everything possible, even though it's going to cost a lot, to make sure no one has even the slightest doubt that our arsenal will survive a first strike and we can retaliate. And similarly, in this field, we have to do everything possible in the economic sphere, in the trade sphere, in the diplomatic sphere, military, of course, to make sure that China has every doubt in the world that if they go for Taiwan, that the consequences to them, that China has no doubts, I should say, that if they go for Taiwan, the consequences to them will be absolutely devastating on every level. And it's important to note that the stakes for China here are absolutely huge. I think Xi Jinping knows very well that if he goes for Taiwan and he loses, that will be the end of his rule and likely the end of the Chinese Communist Party rule over China. Unlike Putin, who could survive losing a war in Ukraine because the goals that he's defined in that, what he calls special military operation, are so nebulous, right? Demilitarization, denazification, who knows what that even means? I've argued in the past that if he wanted to look for a way out, he could just declare mission accomplished, we've achieved victory, and end that conflict. Well, China can't do that. Their goals are very clear, which is taking that island. And if they go for it and they lose, they'll immediately change the status quo, because I think the first thing that Taiwan does in that scenario is declare independence. And now you've forever changed the whole nature of the standoff, where Taiwan is on a very different trajectory, and you've not been able to achieve the one thing that you've said publicly, as he has, is essential to Chinese nation's reemergence and revitalization.
Last question here, but it's actually my favorite part of the book. Along the lines of thinking about China's timeline, thinking about Xi's thinking, you have a very specific timeline in the book. The book opens on November 13th, 2028, with an imagined chapter from the future, a dispatch from the future, about China launching an invasion of Taiwan. Why there? Why that date? What's your argument for why that date might actually end up mattering?
Yeah, so I don't actually think that Xi Jinping has penciled a date certain yet. I don't think the invasion is imminent. I think we have years before he thinks about ordering such an invasion. But I do think the window opens in late 2028 and potentially closes, at least in his mind, in 2032, which could very well be the end of his last term in office. He'll be 79 at that point, unclear that he could get another term in office. He wants to do this. It's very clear. On his own watch, so he can claim credit for it, go down in Chinese history if he succeeds as someone who has eclipsed even the role of Mao. He did the one thing that Mao could never do, which is take Taiwan. So I believe those 4 years, 28 through 32, are incredibly dangerous. There's a lot of talk in the media about 27, and it all stems from the fact that the U.S. intelligence community has assessed that he had given the order for the PLA to be ready to invade Taiwan by 27. I think that's highly unlikely to happen in 27 for a number of reasons. One of them being that 27 is a very busy calendar for Xi Jinping. He's preparing for his reelection in the Chinese Communist Party as premier, which will take place in the fall. It's a lot of things to get done and consolidate his power, and rolling the dice on an invasion does not seem very smart. By the way, that's another reason why I think he's given the order to be ready by 27, is because politically he wants to be able to come on that stage and announce to the Communist Party membership that he now has achieved the capability to take Taiwan by force if they choose to do so. So I don't think that, A, they'll be ready by 27, or that politically it makes sense. And the first part of 28 will also be very busy for him, assuming he gets reelected in October, November of 27. The next 6 to 8 months on the Chinese political calendar are very busy with sort of creating the bureaucracy, sort of in some ways analogous to what happens when a new president gets inaugurated, and it takes many, many months to fill the critical roles in different departments of the U.S. government. You have the similar situation happening in China. You have sort of the new ideological ideas that are being put together for the next 5 years. So it's a very busy time. I think it's too busy to launch an invasion. You sort of get past that in late summer, and that's when you can start thinking about an invasion. 28 is a very interesting year because in January of that year, you're going to have elections in Taiwan, and in May, inauguration of a potentially new president in Taiwan. You have the Summer Olympics taking place in Los Angeles here in the United States. So that'll be a big distraction for the country that may potentially give China some wiggle room to do more preparations and not have the world pay attention as much. And then you have the elections coming up in 2028, November of 2028, where, you know, it's now very clear that the next president, as we're sitting today, will very likely be Joe Biden or Donald Trump, the two nominees of their respective parties. And both of them, you know, not to mention their age, but by term limits, will not be running in 2028. So you are, by definition, going to have a new president that's going to be installed or winning, at least in November of 2028. So you have a lot of distraction happening, a lame duck presidency in 2028 potentially, and you could have a situation where it gives China an opportunity to go. But I think it's going to be very dependent on the circumstances, on his own preparedness and his belief that his forces are prepared, the preparedness of the U.S. military, of the Taiwanese, Japanese, Australians, the range of forces that he would be facing potentially should he launch. But the other thing that we do in this book, in that prologue, is we outline a very detailed scenario of how this invasion would unfold. And I spent a lot of time in Taiwan and talking to their military, talking to folks that have spent from our military that have spent time there. One of my good friends, Ivan Kanapathy, who has been the U.S. military attaché to Taiwan. We actually toured the island and looked at the different potential landing sites and the terrain. And you get the appreciation that Saving Private Ryan, Chinese edition, this is not going to be. That is completely unrealistic, this idea of storming the beaches. The terrain just doesn't allow it. Taiwan Strait is very treacherous waters. Half of the year, you basically can't pass it unless you're in a huge container ship. You've got mountains, you've got rivers, you've got tunnels. It is just a nightmare of an island to try to take over. And in fact, the U.S. itself in World War II bypassed it and invaded Okinawa instead because of the difficulties of entrenched Chinese forces on Formosa, as it was called in the time. So, you know, we lay out the scenario of how could you actually do it if you're China, spend a lot of time thinking about it, wargaming it. So I think people will find it very, very interesting and intriguing. And in fact, I had dinner with General Petraeus a couple of weeks ago, who's read the book. He's been very kind to give an endorsing blurb of the book. And he said, Dimitri, that is one devilish scenario, devilishly clever.
And we know, by the way, that China is thinking about this. I mean, one of the really amazing things that we've seen in the news headlines in the last couple of weeks is a report from some open source satellite researchers pointing out that there is a Chinese military base, I think in the Mongolian desert, where the street layout that has been recreated in the desert precisely matches the streets in and around the Taiwanese presidential palace. So China's out there, you know, looking at and thinking about how it would assault the presidential palace if it needed to or wanted to someday.
That's right. This is the largest Chinese military training base in the country. It is in Inner Mongolia, and it is absolutely striking to overlay that road network that they've built on that base in recent years with the road networks in Taipei that literally just encompasses that presidential palace in Taipei that I visited on my recent trip there. And, you know, when you think about it, it's one thing to prepare for war. It's one thing to start thinking about how do you know, attack Taiwanese military bases if you're China. It's another thing to prepare for an invasion of the presidential palace, because that is not sort of preparing for some potential conflict with your neighbor where you might think, well, maybe they'll attack us or whatever. You are planning for a takeover of the government, right? You're planning to orchestrate a coup and institute your own government. That's the only reason why you would plan to do sort of a special forces mission on the presidential palace. So clearly they are thinking about it. Clearly they're working towards this. It's still very difficult. And I think the key message in the book is that this is not predetermined. Unlike Ukraine, we can still do a lot to deter this conflict. And all of us really have to do everything in our power to do so. And we end the book with Latin, as most of our listeners undoubtedly know. The Roman senator Cato the Elder, about 2,100 years ago in the Roman Senate, would close out every speech with the phrase "Carthago delenda est," Carthage must be destroyed. And we end the book with the Latin phrase "Sine deterrenda sunt," China must be deterred. And all of us should be thinking every single day, how do we contribute to that mission?
The book is World on the Brink, How America Can Beat China in the Race for the 21st Century. And as you said, if you don't trust our word for it, General David Petraeus says it's an urgent, thought-provoking warning about one of the biggest challenges facing America today, a must-read on the most important issue in the world. Out April 30th from Public Affairs Press. Dimitri, where can people get this book?
They can get it in their favorite bookstores, Amazon, Politics and Prose. If you live in DC, I'll be doing a talk there with Jim Shooter from CNN on April 30th, the week of the release. And you will find me and Garrett around the country talking about this in the coming months. And Garrett, I really want to thank you for the incredible collaboration on this book over the last 2 years. You are an amazing writer. It's my first book, and I've learned so much from you in how to write a book and how to make it compelling and interesting. And thanks so much for joining me on this podcast.
It's been a great conversation and a great process working with you. And I learned a lot working through it. And I think it's a fascinating look at the next decade of America's geopolitics.
And now, please enjoy this excerpt from the World on the Brink audiobook, narrated by Will Collier.
Prologue. A Dispatch from the Future. November 13th, 2028. The winter season in Taiwan, lasting from November till March, is great for surfers. It's no Bali or Hawaii, as the size of the waves and their consistency may vary, but the northeast monsoon, which brings the cold China coastal current water into the Taiwan Strait, where it meets the warm Kuroshio branch current coming from the south, is known to form some significant waves. The Taiwan Strait is only about 100 meters deep, shallow enough that during ice ages and the time of glaciers, the island of Taiwan was physically connected to the Chinese mainland. But even in the modern era, the 200-mile-long passage, which varies in width from about 100 nautical miles down to just 70 nautical miles and is one of the most vital shipping routes in the world, is known for frequent storms, large swells, and blinding fog, and bedeviled by annual summer typhoons from roughly May to October. Between the typhoons in the summer and the stormy high-wave winter season, there is no predictably perfect and easy time to launch a large-scale amphibious invasion of Taiwan, especially with the strait registering about 150 days a year of winds above 20 knots, rough seas for amphibious ships and landing craft. Any landing on Taiwan's windy, shallow, and rocky beaches during that time is fraught and risky. Which is why, in the end, China decided to forego a beach landing and attempt an air assault on the island's port and airfield facilities, the seizure of which would allow for rapid arrival of follow-on troops and logistical supplies to facilitate a successful occupation. The operations planners in the People's Liberation Army, PLA, had had years to deliberate their invasion strategy, adjusting year after year as China's own military capabilities grew and advanced. In the end, due to the unpredictability of the rough Taiwan Strait waters and the heavy fortifications the Taiwanese had built up around potential beach landing sites, the PLA came up with an innovative invasion plan, the opening stages of which they'd practiced repeatedly as the late 2020s unfolded. For several years, China had engaged in full-scale military exercises, loading up vast armadas of military and civilian ships with tens of thousands of troops, equipment, and materiel, and heading toward Taiwan, always stopping just short of the 12 nautical mile limit that marks the start of the island's territorial waters. They figured they could practice with some impunity because they knew Taiwan could never afford to respond aggressively. One of the island's greatest defense dilemmas had long been its inability to respond to hostile provocations and threats with force, lest it be accused of instigating a conflict. U.S. officials had warned Taiwanese leadership for years that under no circumstances could they fire the first shot. They had to take the Chinese punch before retaliating. Portraying China as the aggressor would be a critical step in building the international case that Chinese leader Xi Jinping was alone responsible for starting any war. The stakes couldn't have been higher. After all, even if the Taiwanese fired first at the PLA armada after it crossed Taiwan's territorial boundary, Beijing could still dispute the shooting as unprovoked and claim that it occurred in international waters, muddying the geopolitical waters such that Taiwan risked losing key moral and diplomatic support around the world. Too many countries wanted the excuse. They would only be too eager to continue trading with China, the world's second-largest economy, irrespective of the conflict. If Taiwan was to survive and rally the world to its cause, it couldn't afford to offer that excuse. The final Chinese PLA plan counted on precisely that Taiwanese restraint when China's ships entered Taiwan's waters and closed in on the vital northwestern coastal port of Taipei, a modern facility completed in 2012 that boasted 4,500 feet of so-called berth space, a substantial amount of space available for cargo offloading. There, the PLA planned to leverage existing infrastructure to rapidly unload hundreds of thousands of troops and thousands of tanks, armored vehicles, heavy engineering equipment, weapons, munitions, and the logistics supplies needed for the conquest of the island. While Taipei wasn't the largest port in Taiwan, the rapid capture of its docks was essential to the success of the operation, since other Taiwanese port facilities were too far away from the capital city. That distance and Taiwan's extensive array of steep mountains and winding rivers made the rapid transport of a large PLA armored force from any other port or beach to the capital all but impossible. The operational plan called for moving 8 modern Type 075 Yushan-class amphibious assault ships, each with more than 30,000-ton displacement, right up to Taiwan's maritime border, while being protected by PLA Navy, PLAN, guided missile destroyers. Xi Jinping's regime had rapidly constructed the Yushan ships specifically with this mission in mind. Each was a highly capable delivery platform for air assault operations, carrying a mix of up to 28 attack and heavy transport helicopters and 800 troops. In the early morning hours, once the final order was given, 200 Z-8 and Z-20 transport helicopters, all backed up by Z-10 attack gunships, would take off from the landing docks and head for the Taipei port, as well as the Taoyuan International Airport, 10 miles west, and the smaller Taipei Songshan Airport, located right in the center of the capital city, just 3 miles north of the Zhongjiang government district. The plan called for helicopters to make the journey in 10 minutes. Ironically, these aircraft were built based on legally acquired Western technology. The Z-8 came from an original French-licensed design, and the Z-20 from the UH-60 Black Hawk, which America had sold to China in the 1980s. The Z-10 was built with Pratt & Whitney engines and assisted by European Airbus and Augusta Westland transmission and rotor installation designs. The Heliborne Brigades of the PLA Air Force, PLA-AF Airborne Corps, China's equivalent to the United States' 101st Airborne Division, would assault, capture, and secure the port and airport facilities in preparation for follow-on forces with armored vehicles that would land at the airfields on the Chinese Y-20 and Russian-made IL-76 troop transport planes. As those transport planes descended, dozens of large roll-on, roll-off, RORO, ferries, and vehicle transport ships, all built with national defense requirements and appropriated from Chinese industry by the PLAN, would rush into the captured port and unload tens of thousands of troops and hundreds of additional tanks and infantry fighting vehicles. Anticipating that the Taiwanese might manage to destroy the port's infrastructure ahead of the Chinese landing, the PLA has spent years practicing rapid offloading of these vessels in ports with minimal cargo handling infrastructure, such as a lack of pierside ramps or tugboat support. Simultaneously, PLA land-based missiles, rockets, and bombers, along with attack aircraft deployed from two Chinese carriers positioned off Taiwan's eastern coast, would pummel Taiwan's air bases in an attempt to take the island's relatively small air force out of commission before it could get into the fight, destroying runways, fuel depots, and maintenance infrastructure, and targeting the island's prized fleet of F-16 fighter jets. Mainland-based precision-guided ballistic and cruise missiles, such as DF-17 hypersonics, together with long-range, truck-mounted PHL-16 multiple rocket launchers and kamikaze drones, would all target stationary radars, fixed weapons platforms, critical command, control, communications nodes, naval facilities, energy infrastructure, and TV and radio transmission towers to sow chaos and impede the highly centralized decision-making of the Taiwanese military. American-built Patriot air defense batteries, as well as Taiwan's indigenously developed Skybow systems, troop barracks, and anti-ship batteries, were also high-priority targets. Achieving the invasion's main political objective, the rapid assault and capture of key government installations in Taipei, including the Presidential Office Building and the Ministry of National Defense, relied on assault forces delivered by dozens of fast Type 726 Yuyi-class air-cushioned landing craft, LCAC, racing up the Tamsui River. The wide but relatively shallow river snakes through the mountains that separate the beaches on Taiwan's western shore from the center of the city, and empties into the strait in the Bali district, right next to the port of Taipei. Its tributaries pass near most of the key government installations in the city. That geography meant that the LCACs, deployed from the Yushan amphibious ships sitting at the mouth of the Tamsui and powered by large gas turbines and capable of achieving speeds of 80 knots, could deliver a battalion of marines and armored vehicles directly into the heart of Taipei's government district in under 15 minutes. The 1-2 punch of the fast boats advancing up the river while airborne troops landed via rotor and fixed-winged aviation at the Taipei Songshan Airport would allow the PLA to rapidly bring the fight to Taiwan's seat of government. While the PLAN Marines captured Taipei's government and communication centers, the armored and infantry divisions would arrive on the island's northwestern coast, unload at the port and nearby airport on the other side of the mountains from Taipei city center, and then drive onto the highways that encircle Taiwan, racing toward the key population centers and military bases and hoping to overwhelm defenses. Having exercised each element of the plan for years, including simulated fast LCAC boat city assaults on the Pearl River near Hong Kong, Xi Jinping's military generals assured him that the plan would achieve a rapid conquest of Taiwan before the rest of the world, especially the United States, had a chance to intervene to save the island. Xi Jinping chose November 13, 2028, as China's D-Day, loading up his invasion fleet and issuing his final ultimatum. With little to show after years of so-called gray zone tactics aimed at non-violently forcing Taiwan to choose political unification with the Chinese mainland, tactics that ranged from constant economic and military pressure, to social and traditional media influence campaigns, to bribing and blackmailing of politicians, She had finally concluded that only military force would bring about achievement of this long-desired objective. As the 2020s progressed, Chinese military planners had presented one alternative strategy after another, including a last-chance alternative to an all-out invasion, a naval and air blockade aimed at isolating the island, which was heavily reliant on food and energy imports, and forcing its surrender without a fight. But in meeting after meeting, presentation after presentation, war game after war game, the blockade seemed unlikely to succeed. She worried that America would undermine the blockade with its formidable underwater and surface naval fleet and air power. He also worried about the economic effects, how the rest of the world would react to a prolonged confrontation across the strait that would surely cause a humanitarian disaster on the island and supply chain disruptions beyond it, ripples that would impact China itself. The United States and its allies might even launch a counterblockade of Chinese maritime oil and gas imports, a move that could paralyze China before its own blockade took a decisive toll on Taiwan. Any Chinese naval blockade was also likely to provoke Taiwan to take the one step it had never yet formally done, declaring full independence and irrevocably changing the geopolitical status quo. And perhaps most crucially for Xi, the approach of laying a prolonged siege to the island ran counter to his strong preference for resolving China's Taiwan problem in a rapid and decisive manner, to rip off the Band-Aid and present the world with the fait accompli of Chinese conquest and the long-awaited integration of Taiwan into the People's Republic of China. Thus, after spending that summer and fall in strategy sessions, briefings, and quiet lone contemplation at Beidaiha, the Communist Party elite's seaside retreat, and in the party's Zhongnanhai compound in Beijing, Xi had settled on an invasion. As he concluded, if he was to take the step of mobilizing the military, risk a conflict with America, and cause a potential global backlash, it was best to go all the way and try to end it as quickly as possible. Victory, he'd been told by his generals and military advisors, would be swift, and the Taiwanese resistance would be quickly vanquished. They had assured him that China's decades-long investment in new military systems, weapons, and training would be decisive. It wasn't even clear to Xi and the Communist Party's Central Military Commission that the Americans would ultimately choose to fight for Taiwan once they saw the might of the China invasion fleet, once they calculated the price of the war in tens of thousands of American lives. Even if they did fight, the U.S. military was far away, nearly 500 miles away on Okinawa, or 1,700 miles away in Guam. We can hold them at bay long enough while our airborne assault units quickly secure key critical infrastructure resources on the island, and our landing force rapidly crosses the strait and secures the rest of the country to create a sense of fait accompli, Xi's top military advisor had promised in the final briefing the previous week. Xi believed the time for hesitancy was over. The time to act was now. As he saw it, victory would be his and his place in history assured. His ascent into the pantheon of Chinese historical leaders would be unmatched. My friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.